and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of One Perfect Game, the show about video games and the people who play them. My name is Matt Tilby. I am the host of this wonderful adventure, and my guest for today's episode is the director of Stupid Old Studios, a live space in Melbourne for comedians and content creators. And this is where he also hosts Gamey Gamey Game, a gaming show featuring some of Australia's best and brightest comedians that you can watch on YouTube and Twitch. I am delighted to introduce Evan Munro Smith to the show. Evan, welcome on in. How are you doing?
Hey, thanks so much for having me. I'm very good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing very well. It's as we're recording the end of the, well, I guess the final working week before Christmas. Everyone's sort of powering down for, I guess, the predominant end of the year celebrations. But yep. It's been a big year for you and Stupid Old. I guess the biggest thing that's really sort of happened is you've announced an initiative called a Comedy Lab. Can you tell the audience a bit about what that's going to be?
Yeah, so this is something that we've kind of had in the works for a little while. It's sort of an idea that we've had and we've been talking to people about, but there were so many questions around how to do it that we kind of just, it was in the too hard part for quite a while. And just getting to the end of the year, we're just like, oh, we should finally just do it, just like announce it, launch it, do what we can. To sort of get the ball rolling on it and kind of work out the details as we go and as people kind of react to it. But it's because we're a production company. As you said, we're a live space as well. We're a creative hub where people work out of this building, people do podcasts, people film stuff, write shows, whatever. Like, it's a very creative space all centered around the comedy scene here in Melbourne. And as a production company, we have great production spaces. We have a lot of equipment. We have a team of people who do writing and shooting and editing and all this sort of stuff, kind of every part of the process. So we thought it'd be really cool to have a program that makes all that stuff available to comedians who might not be able to kind of afford to like pay us through our normal sort of client process. And we always have a soft spot for comedians, and we always try to make stuff affordable for people, but we're also a business that needs to, we've got to pay rent, we've got to pay wages and all that sort of thing. So we kind of just, we do what we can in terms of giving people stuff for free or at a steep discount. But Comedy Lab is a new thing where it's sort of leaning on our community a bit and on like industry partners and peers to sort of crowdfund a pool of money that can be used to sort of cover our costs while we provide our resources, our time, to up-and-coming comedians for the most part. There's comedians that, whether they're mates of ours or whether they're people who we've never heard of, hopefully it's more people that we've never heard of that we're reaching out to. It's just trying to make that stuff available to them for free so that they can make stuff that they just wouldn't have been able to make otherwise. So it's quite a fairly ambitious sort of, it's a new model that I haven't seen other people do before, and it's been really cool to announce it and kind of share it with people. We've had a great response from artists who, have sort of, we just wouldn't have heard from them before. But since we've done that call out, you got all these people with all these great ideas who want to make stuff they would have just been like, it was too expensive. There's no way we could have done that. But sort of since we've opened this door for people, we're hearing all these great ideas. We really want to make it all happen. And we've had a great response from the community as well. We've almost reached the goal that we set ourselves, which was to get to $1,000 a month. I think we're like 850 or something at the moment. So we're getting really close to that, and we're really excited to kick it off in the new year and help out, just try to help make as many projects as we can.
Yeah, definitely. And it sounds like the support that you guys have been getting, even in sort of only, it's been what, 2 or so weeks since you really sort of announced it, and everyone's really sort of shown a lot of enthusiasm and support for it, obviously, as well, alongside the sort of monthly recurring donations. There's also been plenty of one-time donations as well.
People have been really generous with that, and it's very, very nice, very much appreciated.
Yeah, it seems like a really cool idea, a really nice initiative. It's just interesting to see how, I guess, wide open that sort of comedy landscape is, not only in Melbourne, but like, I guess, the eastern part of the country, really. Like, because there's been a lot of people who I've heard of, have been really interested in it, and people I know and people who I probably don't even know yet have been sort of applying for it. So are you sort of surprised at the sort of like feedback and response?
Yeah, you kind of. I guess the main thing with this, and one of the reasons that we were sitting on it for a little while without really kind of announcing or saying anything about it, was we just didn't know what to expect. Like there was part of us that was like, well, maybe no one's going to be interested in, or there aren't many, maybe there won't be many people who are interested in using our studio for stuff. Maybe it's not a very useful thing for people. Maybe people just need money or something like that, which obviously would be helpful, but it's a different kind of thing. And we also weren't sure kind of how the community would kind of respond. So it was very much like, we just had no idea where to set our expectations on this stuff. So in a way, it is surprising. Like, we have been surprised by some of the stuff that's some of the artists that have gone in touch, and it's been interesting to have people get in touch with stuff that we in our minds we're like, oh, maybe they want to rehearse a show, maybe they want to start a podcast. But we've been getting more interesting. Well, we've been getting that, which is great. But we've also been getting just more interesting stuff from people that we just hadn't thought of before. And so that's really cool.
Yeah, of course. It's such a weird and wacky sort of landscape trying to create things like, you know, podcasts and comedy and even live shows as well, having seen a couple of sort of live performances recorded for YouTube. And of course, obviously, one of the other things that you do at Stupid Old is record shows like Gamey Gamey Game, I mean, I've only sort of recently jumped onto the Gamey sort of bandwagon, but this show has been going for a lot longer than I expected. What has that sort of like journey been for you, I guess, sort of looking back on it?
Yeah, it's been an interesting journey. So I guess, when did it start? Must have been like 2017 or 2018. I'm not sure. Maybe 2017. So yeah, what is that? 5-6 years? It's been an interesting journey. It started off as me just wanting to do something that was my own project, because for years I went to film school, I kind of did stuff in community TV, I've worked in the industry doing various things as a producer, a director, shooter, editor, all that sort of stuff. But a lot of it has just been as a freelancer, or, you know, even just a Stupid Old Studios as a video producer sort of a role. And I kind of had this realization, a lot of my friends are comedians. I'm sort of immersed in this world of comedians and other creatives who are like, they've got their own projects that they're making. And I really enjoyed working on those projects and helping them out on that stuff. But I had this realization of like, I don't have anything that is my own thing. So I didn't really know what it was I wanted to do. And I just had the thought that one of my passions, like for my whole life, has been video games. And so I thought, if I was going to make something, then that makes sense as a place to start, as a thing to make something about. And so for ages I was like talking to people about it, talking to Beck, my partner, who got very sick of it very quickly, me just sort of talking around in circles. But I didn't know who'd get to host it, and so I was just, you know, thinking who should be on it, who should host the show. And then I think it was her that suggested that I host. I'm like, oh, I don't know. I've never hosted anything. I've never really done anything on camera before. I'd done a little bit of like, I don't know, public speaking, or like, you know, I used to do stuff on community radio and stuff. So I'd had a little bit of experience kind of as the, you know, talent sort of role, I suppose. But the idea of hosting a thing, I just wasn't sure about. So it started off very like, yeah, I don't know. I think I was just very nervous about what, I didn't know what the show was really. I didn't know if I'd be any good as a host. I felt like I had comedy friends on the show that would like, to me, just like amazing comedians. And I'm this little guy in the middle that's just like, I, you know, like I'm not a comedian. I'd never called myself a comedian. And so I don't know. It was very much like finding its feet for that first little bit. I also didn't know if anyone was going to watch it, and kind of no one really did to begin with. But it slowly grew, and it did. You know, after maybe a couple of years, it really kind of settled into this format that it is now, which is it's a bit longer. It's very silly. It's more a comedy show than a gaming show. We're not here to really provide like earnest reviews of games or information about stuff, really. It's all just about trying to find stuff that's funny and having funny conversations, whether it's on topic or off topic, and being a place to sort of just showcase great comedians that we work with. And yeah, it's definitely like, it's come a long way. It's had some real road bumps through COVID and us moving studios. It really got derailed for the last couple of years. We used to have a pretty consistent sort of release schedule, but yeah, over the last couple of years, it's really it's been harder to keep it as a consistent release schedule. It's now kind of fallen into when we're able to do it, we'll do it, and I'm hoping that will kind of stabilize a bit for next year. But yeah, it's definitely been an interesting journey.
Yeah, and I think it's part of the magic, I think, personally, of the show is just the fact that, like you sort of said, it is a gaming show, like my name, but there's not a lot of gaming chat to be had. There's probably maybe 10 or so minutes of gaming chat, and then the rest is just anything that the guests and host can sort of think of, which I think makes it such an unpredictable and very sort of like unique show within the gaming landscape. But
yeah, I think that's it. It is different to, and certainly at the time I wanted to create something that I didn't think existed elsewhere. I think ultimately I was a bit insecure and didn't want to invite direct comparison to something else that was being made. I wanted to try and create something that was a bit different. And even just like naming the show, like it is a silly name. And I originally I think everyone that starts a gaming podcast or show or whatever goes through the same process of going through a list of like next level polygon stuff or like
8-bit
just blanking on gaming terms now, but just like, or you know, you just like brainstorm a list of gaming stuff and every single one of them sounds lame, or it's either it sounds lame or it's been done a bunch of times, and so it's really hard to try and come up with something that has a bit of an identity around that. So and I ended up just settling on Gamey Gamey Game because I think it says everything it needs to say. It's just so much easier to just go like, let's just call it something dumb. Don't pretend it's something earnest. You know, it's all about setting the expectation. I think the problem you have, and we've managed to avoid a lot of like YouTube backlash, people being angry. That's one of the things I was so worried about, especially in the gaming community on YouTube and Twitch and other, you know, these online communities, is that people really care about games. And if you're making fun of them or whatever, people can get just respond really badly and be very angry. And so I think it was important for us to set it up, set expectations first so that people aren't expecting this. You know, we never say, we're never a review show. I never talk about reviewing games. We don't do news really. We do one news story at the top of the show that is really just a silly thing. And sort of setting up those rules ahead of time, giving it a silly name. It's all about just getting people set up for this so that they know this isn't IGN or something, or Kotaku or Polygon or these other ones that are doing proper journalism. That's not what we're about. We're just about just being silly.
I love the running gag that most of the news stories are VR related, and then the fact that for a review show, well, technically classed as a review show, as I'm using air quotes for the listeners, the hosts and the panelists sometimes will either not play a lot of the game or play the game at all, which I think makes it so unpredictable and sort of wild in that sense. Like the most recent episode for people who are interested, you guys did Modern Warfare 3, the new Call of Duty that came out.
Yeah.
And like a game like that is always going to polarize a pretty sort of like casual gaming audience. And you guys just went to town on it, honestly.
Yeah, it's... Firstly, I think I love VR. I just think VR is very funny, and that's why I keep bringing it up, because I think it is the metaverse. It's just inherently funny. It's some of it is just the logistical thing of we're putting together a bunch of comedians on the show. Not all of the comedians we want to have on the show are gamers, and we can't realistically expect that everyone's going to be able to play the game to be able to come to it with a credible opinion every week, you know? We don't, if we will sometimes get review copies if we're organized. Usually we're not organized. We can usually reach out and get review codes of games, but it's usually taking the piss a bit if we're like, hey, can we have 4 review codes, please? And, you know, on these various systems just to try to work out what, you know, and a lot of comedians that we have on the show, they might have a Switch, but they don't have a PC, a gaming PC, or they might not have a PS5 or Xbox Series X or whatever. So it's just like, you know, as much as we try to come to, I think as long as one of us has played the game or can come to it with some credibility, I think it's fine. The others can just sort of, you know, it, you look at that episode in particular, like Naomi was never going to play Call of Duty. Like she hates that series. Everybody hates it, really. Like it's fun to, I mean, I love it. I have a soft spot for it. But I understand why people hate it. And I think it's always a funny dynamic, right? It's all just part of the comedy dynamic. It's funny for one person like myself to go in batting for a game that everybody hates and just really try and stand up for it. I mean, one, like the best example of that is we did an episode on a game called Songs for a Hero, which was just awful. But, and it, of course, I don't know if you know it. It's a platformer where the main character is literally singing the whole time, singing what he's doing. It's kind of a joke game. And I think it was made by some YouTubers or something like that. But it's not, it's kind of a joke game, but also it's kind of earnest in what it's doing. So everyone just sort of hated on that. But it's fun to be the guy just sort of going, but you know, isn't this good? Like, isn't this sort of fun? And then just everyone else just knocking it down. I think, you know, it's all about contrast and stuff.
You trying to be the voice of reason alongside 3 comedians who are trying to rip your head off for it is always a bit of a fun time.
I love that. And it comes from, like, it's best when it comes from a real place as well. Like, I love racing games. So, but everyone else, everyone else thinks racing games is dumb. I think that's, I don't know. I struggle to phone it in. So when I'm being earnest on the show and really loving something, it's usually because I really do. We did one like early on about Star Wars Pinball on the Switch. I thought that was great. I love that. But it's so fucking dumb. And so, like, of course everyone else is going to shit on it. But I really liked it. And so, it is a fun dynamic. But it's also fun, I think, you know, I'm not playing every game necessarily, or I'm playing it for a little bit or whatever. If we get someone else on the show who is just a massive fan of a series, then it's like, all right, we'll lean on them. You know, they can be the voice of credibility, the voice of authority on that. And then, you know, I can fall back into more just like asking questions and presenting sort of what I've read and that sort of thing. So the dynamic sort of shifts around, and it shifts around a lot depending on who we have on the show and what the game is and whether it's something that we can, I'll often avoid big games that have a lot to talk about just because I'm like, we can't do this justice. Not that we do it justice anyway. Not sure there's a real logic to that, but sometimes I'll deliberately avoid. Like we didn't do Baldur's Gate 3. I'm just like, a lot of people care a lot about this. There's a lot to say about it, but I haven't got anything to say about it because I haven't played it and I haven't played the other ones. So I'm just like, well, let's just dodge that one. But if we had someone on who was, you know, a massive fan of Baldur's Gate, then we would have done it, and I would have just fallen back into that questioning sort of role.
Yeah, for sure. And like, I'll fight by your side in terms of racing games. I absolutely love them. So
they're great. And there's not enough of them these days, I don't think. Exactly. Or there's like Gran Turismo. I don't like the realistic ones so much. I love a Need for Speed. Played so much Need for Speed Heat. That was great. Yeah. Anyway. More racing games.
But Where to next for Stupid Old and Gamey Game? Like, where do you see the show and sort of really the studio in general going to? What's sort of the plans for you going forward?
Oh, it's a big question. I just had like a 4-hour meeting about this the other day. Not about Gamey Game, but about Stupid Old and a very broad conversation about. I think we, as a company, we have a bit of an identity crisis where we're like, who are we and what do we do? We're a lot of things to different people and we do lots of stuff. We're a small team and we're just trying to do a lot of different things. So I think over the next little while what is next for us, I think both Stupid Old and Gamey Game, and hopefully me too, is just finding a bit of stability. I think we've moved, we've been in this building, this new studio that we built. We've been here for a bit over a year, or like open for a bit over a year. And before that, we spent a bit over a year doing fit out, construction, design permits, all the sort of, you know, the nonsense that goes with fitting out a massive warehouse to be a studio. And it was just a super hectic time, like not having a space or having like a half built building that we couldn't really work out of. And, you know, until we got to a point where we could sort of work out of it, but there was still construction going on and kind of working around all that. It's really hard when you're a studio space trying to record stuff. Now that the building is kind of more or less done, it's never actually done, but it's done enough to call it done for now. And, you know, now we can do stuff like we can have Gamey Game in the studio again, and things are just starting to settle a bit. And so the next, I'm hoping 2024 is the year of, is just stabilizing a bit. And you know, I was talking about the irregular release schedule for Gamey Game. It meant that it was just a really hectic kind of project through all of like last year and the year before. Like, it's been really hard. We've had great support from Patreons who have been very tolerant of an irregular release schedule. Always feel bad because, like, you know, they're giving us money every month. And lots of, you know, a bunch of people have dropped off, which is totally fair and very expected. But a bunch of people have stuck with us, which is so nice. Given that, you know, maybe we'll release an episode this month, or maybe that we'll still be working around other stuff. And so I'm hoping that we can get back into like just a regular swing of things. I'm really keen to be reaching out and finding more great panelists. Like, we've introduced a bunch of new people this year. Like, we're always kind of slowly adding people to the pool that we have, sometimes losing people who are, you know, move overseas or go off and do other things. So we kind of have this ever-changing pool of guest talent that we have on the show, but they're all great people. And I'm sure we'll be kind of, you know, adding more and having more people on regularly. And hopefully just life gets a bit less hectic. I'm not sure if it'll ever get less hectic, but you know, stability.
Yeah, I don't think so either. I'm also in the same boat. But yeah, here's hoping that both Stupid Old and Gamey Game can continue kicking some goals and sort of really making some really awesome content. But Evan, we move on to the next section of the show. And normally for our guests in the second portion of the show, we ask them about their upbringing or sort of their formative years when it comes to video games, and whether that be, you know, a first game that they've ever played or a first console or something that they can remember from their childhood. What does that look like for you? Is there a first sort of like gaming related memory that you can remember?
There's some really early memories of my dad. Was a lecturer for RMIT, lecturing in business management, and had a Mac that he had at home to do work stuff on. You know, this must have been early 90s, and we used to play games on that. I loved a game called Jump Raven. There was a game called Bloodbath. This is like early 90s Mac games. Yeah. Loved all that sort of stuff. We didn't really have games consoles until, like, my friends had like PlayStations, and I was very jealous, super excited about like Dreamcast, but I never ever got one. My sister's got a Nintendo 64. I think that was the first console we ever got, was a Nintendo 64.
Nice.
But that was my sister's. So, like, you know, they played Banjo-Kazooie and Zelda and stuff, which is like, good on them. but I was much more into much more violent games, and so I stuck to PC for most of my formative years. Are PC games? I did get a PS2 when they came out, but yeah, so much was like Doom, Quake. I love when I was really little. I used to play a game called Rise of the Triad, which I didn't even know what it was called. I used to just call it the two gun game because you could like dual wield pistols and stuff. And whenever I said that, my dad knew what I wanted to play. Great game. Very violent for my very young age. But yeah, all about shooters when I was a kid.
It's a very alarming, I guess, common thread that seems to run through all of your chosen games. But it's interesting you mention a lot of the, like, Mac games, because it's like we had one of those, like, fluorescent back like Macs when we were in primary school. Like, you know, the ones that sort of had like the colored backs, like the sort of blue and orange ones. And they were super all the rage, like around the, like, it was like 2099 sort of era. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember trying to do some editing on one of those at, in like my high school media department had one of those running like Premiere version 2 or something like that. Oh my God. Yeah. Nightmare. We had an earlier one at home. It was, must have been, I keep wanting to say an Apple II. I'm not sure if that's actually what it was. I'm going to Google it. Apple II. No, it was later than that. Okay. No, it was a Macintosh. Anyway, look, it's, I'm not sure exactly what it was, but it was like an all in one unit with the tiny screen and
like big chunky back. It was like almost like a sort of oval, sort of like oblongy sort of shape. But it was just like they had some of the weirdest games on those ones. I remember playing a game called Cro-Mag Rally that was a racing game set in the prehistoric era. Yeah, there was a game called Bugdom that was sort of like a platformer as a bug. Like all of these like really bizarre sort of titles that I'd never seen anywhere else on a PC or anything. But it's like those weird games that sort of like stick with you, those sorts of moments. So it's good that you've been given that opportunity with the early Mac on your side. But you sort of mentioned like, yeah, your Dooms, your Quakes. I'm assuming Wolfenstein is probably in there as well.
Yeah,
like,
for sure. Spirit of Destiny. Corridor 7 was a fun one. I don't know if you ever played Corridor 7.
No,
that
I haven't.
Was like a... Is the fun little thing I remember about that is that... Yeah, like it had multiplayer and stuff. It must have been an MS-DOS game. It might have been on Mac. I can't remember. But anyway, you could... enemies would disguise themselves as plants and stuff. Like as just like... stuff in the world, and in multi, I think you could multiplayer and you could pretend to be something, and that's come up in a game recently. I'm trying to remember what
sort of like Prop Hunt.
Yeah, that sort of thing. I feel like in the game that you could walk upside down in. That's a bad example.
Like VVVVV.
No, I'm thinking of I don't know what I'm thinking of. I'm like a massive... they rebooted it and it was totally different. Don't worry. It's fine. But anyway, you could pretend to be a plant. That was fun.
Okay. That's an excellent, excellent description. And I'll have to make sure I find that game that you're thinking of.
Yeah, anyway.
It's racking his brain now, listeners.
It's going to bother me now.
Well, while you think of that, obviously, you sort of, as you got a little bit older and sort of went into high school and sort of, you know, got a bit older. And as you said, you picked up a PlayStation 2 and sort of went into like getting more of those sorts of games. Was the shooter genre something that sort of stuck with you as you got older? Or did your palette evolve into something a little bit more, a little bit more broad?
I don't think my palette really evolved. No, I don't think so. I loved shooters. Look, most games that I played were shooters. I did love StarCraft. There were racing games that I really liked too. I've always kind of liked Need for Speed. But definitely the games I played the most were shooters. So much like, Quake 3 Arena, Call of Duty. Even like third-person ones, Gears of War and stuff as well. Yeah, I don't know what it was about them, but I just loved shooting stuff. Violence is great, I guess.
The big one for me, I guess, in that era was really the Time Splitters series.
Oh, love Time Splitters. Oh my God, reading the Time Splitters studio, Free Radical
has just closed. Down,
Oh man. Although then I read a follow up headline that was like that at one point they were turning Time Splitters into like a Fortnite clone. I'm like, that doesn't sound good.
Yeah, doesn't fill me with a lot of hope. But yeah, hearing the Free Radical.
Prey was the game I was thinking of.
That
is a very confusing. You could in the first one, you could walk upside down, and then they did a reboot. Right. I don't know if you could walk upside down anymore. I didn't really play that one so much, but I think in that game you could pretend to be a plant. Maybe I can't remember.
Now that you mention it, sort of having like the items like chairs and things sort of hidden as enemies, that makes a lot more sense and it rings a lot more of a bell now.
Yeah.
So okay, I appreciate that.
I'm glad I could think of it because it was bothering me.
Yeah. But yeah, no, like I think, yeah, those sorts of shooters, I guess, especially around that sort of like PS2, Xbox 360 sort of era, were definitely trying to find their footing a little bit. Like even, as you said, like, yeah, the Time Splitters series was trying to figure out what it wanted to do. And I think those sorts of titles were really sort of trying to evolve and sort of stay relevant. But I think, I don't know why I picked Time Splitters as that sort of like go-to series. I think it was just...
I still love that so much. Really sort of caught... There was a time in COVID where I started... My memory is bad for this stuff because it's so sideways to the business that I run full time doing video production. But I played a game that has Time Splitters 2 levels in it as an Easter egg. So it's the only way that you can play. It's the only way to play Time Splitters 2 games on PC.
Yes, it's Homefront: The Revolution.
Yes,
I looked it up because I was interested about it, and that everyone was like, "Is there a way to play Time Splitters 2 on PC?" And it's like, yeah, you've got to buy an entirely different game and get to the arcade in the level.
Yeah, and I did that. It's like you have to play like 2/3 of the way through the game or something like that. I didn't hate it. I thought it was a fine game. I think it got a lot of bad reviews when it first launched, Homefront. But by the time I was playing it, maybe they'd fixed a bunch. But I thought it was fine. But yeah, really, it was just about getting to that arcade and being able to play Time Splitters 2 on PC without needing like an emulator or something. That was really cool. That man, Time Splitters 2. It really is an all-time favorite of mine for sure.
Yeah, I think I had one of those like PS2 demo discs when they used to sort of distribute that with magazines all the time, and on the disc was the first level, which was like the Siberian Dam, and obviously the comparisons to GoldenEye and coming through, and obviously the link with Free Radical having former GoldenEye devs comes through again, and it's sort of like it makes so much sense. But it's like that level and then the layout and sort of what you need to do and everything is sort of like burned into my brain, and I will
never forget
it until the day I die. And
I wish there were more of us out there who, you know, enough to make them make more.
I know.
But yeah, it's so good.
It's a soft spot in my heart for it. But they obviously just released it as backwards compatibility, both Time Splitters 2 and Future Perfect on Xbox. So I've been managing to pick them up and sort of play them, so it's been a really sort of nice nostalgia trip for me. But on that note, I guess, but we might as well move on to the game that you've chosen for us for today, Evan, and it sort of continuing on that shooter front. It's a particularly classic title from that sort of like early to mid 2000s era. What have you chosen for us?
I chose Red Faction, and it's an interesting one because for me it was like an obsession, but I don't know if like were you across Red Faction? Had you played that before? Are you aware of it? I'm not sure how big it was in the scheme of, you know, gaming culture.
At the time it definitely, because this is when I was probably when it released, it was I was probably maybe like 8-9 years old, so it was definitely probably not on my radar as much as it probably should have been. But going back and playing both that and sort of the Red Faction Guerrilla and sort of having the remastered edition coming out recently, I was sort of able to revisit it and sort of really appreciate it for what it was in terms of how revolutionary it was for the first person shooter genre. Once again, sort of mentioning the demo disc, like there were demo discs that had Red Faction on it, and I was like, oh, that's kind of cool, and probably didn't appreciate it as much as I did now, for sure.
Yeah, I think probably a lot of it was the like the destruction tech, being able to like use a rocket launcher to blow up the environment and bits and pieces around was really cool, and it was the first game to really do that, I think. So that definitely caught people's attention. I mean, Half-Life was another game that really stuck with me, and because it was that was revolutionary. I think have we just been celebrating 20 years of Half-Life? Is that there's been a bit of Half-Life content going around?
It was either
recently.
20 or 25, I believe. Yeah,
maybe 25. Maybe that makes sense because it would have been 99, 98. Anyway, so in my mind, Red Faction is not as revolutionary as Half-Life was, but it did have, like, it was technology in a game that we hadn't really seen before. There's like a tech demo level in it called Glasshouse, which is just you're in a big room with a glass house, basically, and you just shoot out the glass, and you can use the rocket launcher to blow shit up and stuff. And that was just a cool little tech demo that was a lot of fun. But that a lot of the game was just like, you can blow stuff up and let's make a game around that idea. But yeah, I loved it. I think it was like, it must have just hit me at the right time. You know, there's just times in your life where you're just like more open to stuff. And I think that just came across me at the right time. And I just thought it was so cool. I loved it. So good. I remember being on holiday in beautiful New Zealand. My parents, we were on a family holiday, and I distinctly remember not wanting to go on holiday because they were doing a Simpsons marathon, all school holidays on Fox 8, on Foxtel. And I'm like, I don't want to go on holiday. I want to watch The Simpsons. And anyway, they forced me to go on holiday. But all I wanted to do when I was on holiday was play Red Faction on my dad's laptop. And it sucked because it was so slow and I couldn't really play it. But I had the PC because I had it on PS2. This was one of the few games that I bought on both console and PC. There really aren't many games that I've done both. I think maybe originally I bought it on PS2 and then it was in New Zealand. I wanted to play it on laptop. And I played it as much on PC as I did on PS2. I just loved it.
Yes. As someone who is also fortunate enough to have had Foxtel and knows the joys of the Saturday and Sunday Simpsons marathon, I can understand the struggle that you've been through.
I realize now they were just filling time with old content, and it's just the easiest thing in the world for a channel to just be like, yeah, I'll just run 4 hours of The Simpsons.
4 hours of The Simpsons, and then WWE straight after. And like, that's it. That's like, that's my Saturday sorted. Like, I'm,
you know,
I'm good.
The very first video game I ever owned was The Simpsons Wrestling. And I owned it on PlayStation before I even owned a console.
So you bought it without the console.
That's right. I went to, I'd entered a competition on, there's a channel, or there was a channel, it doesn't exist anymore, on Foxtel called Fox Kids, where they had a bunch of kids content.
Yeah.
And they run a competition called Lights, Camera, Fox Kids, where you could submit short films or animations or whatever. And we, my sister and I entered the animation category and we won it. We went to Fox Studios in Sydney and did the whole broadcast thing and all this sort of, and so there's a clip that it comes up on Gamer Game sometimes, but a clip of me up on stage accepting the award as like, I was like 11 or 12 years old on this kids thing. Craig Charles gave me the award. It's crazy.
What?
From Red Dwarf. Anyway, and from Robot Wars, which I knew him from.
Yeah,
Red Dwarf was.
that's where I remember him from, because like I used to watch, because I watched Fox Kids as well. It's like I watched Digimon, I watched Fox Kids, like Robot Wars. Like those were the only two shows I watched on that channel, and I watched them religiously. I ended up winning like one of the competitions for Robot Wars to be sent like a whole big box of like, I think they were like pullback Robot Wars toys.
That's cool.
And it was, and like stuff that just was never in like stores as a kid. And I was like, this is all like treasure to me. Like I could just never let it go. That's insane.
Very
like,
exciting
to meet Craig Charles.
Yeah, that was really cool. And also when we won the animation category, it was announced in animation form by MetaBee from Metabots. And so that was exciting too. Because I'm like, it's him. Anyway, we went over there and obviously had a great time, and we won that thing, and we were just like super excited, and like as a reward, there was like at Fox Studios, there's like a Simpsons store, and because as we've explored before in this podcast, I love The Simpsons, And so I was like, I got to go in there. And so there was a PlayStation game and I'm like, I want to, and so I made dad buy me the PlayStation game being like, we'll get a PlayStation at some point. I don't know why he bought it for me. We did because we didn't have one. But maybe
did you
it was
end
that
up getting
Christmas.
The PlayStation?
Well, we got a PlayStation 2. So I think it must have, maybe it was that Christmas that we got a PlayStation 2 for Christmas or something like that. I remember, I think the PS2 was my Christmas and birthday present or something like that. Oh, I was quite a nagger as a kid. I really like, yeah. Thinking back on this, like going, thinking about this, doing this podcast today, I'm starting to realize that I think there may be like a little bit of a streak of, I don't know, autism sounds a bit extreme, but I think I definitely have obsessive tendencies where I will get stuck on something. And I just like, yeah, I just obsess over it. And I think when I think it's more than just like, I want this toy, I want this toy. I think it, for some reason I was absolutely obsessed and I would not let up until my parents bought me a PS2.
As someone who was recently diagnosed with ADHD, I can totally understand the sort of traits and things that you've mentioned there. So, yeah, no, I totally get where you're coming from with
that. I should probably just talk to a therapist, really, shouldn't I? I can actually uncover some of these things.
Yes, but so Red Faction.
Yes, that's what we're talking about.
This is interesting because, like, I'd completely forgotten it was made by Volition, who, of course, went on to do all of the Saints Row games. And so sort of having them do both Red Faction and then moving on to obviously what was like having, I guess, more of like a Quake clone or sort of like a very heavily inspired game through Quake, going on to make a game that is heavily inspired by Grand Theft Auto. So they were able to sort of take the best of both worlds and sort of bring them into their respective games. And it was... it's surprising that sort of tech and sort of inspiration didn't come up as much as it had.
Yeah, I mean, Saints Row, I think I played a bit of one Saints Row game. It was one that never really appealed to me for some reason. I don't know what it was about it. But yeah, it's interesting. I don't know, like, I'm trying to think if Saints Row did any, like, interesting tech stuff or if it was just kind of a bit of a... sort of riding the coattails of GTA with a bit of a different tone to it. I remember, like, I think probably Red Faction is the only Volition game. I wonder if they've done any other stuff outside of that, but the only Volition game that really, really struck a chord for me, because even the follow-up Red Faction games, although were they even Volition? I didn't keep track, but they, the sequels to Red Faction didn't really do much for me. I don't even know if I played Red Faction Guerrilla. Red Faction 2 was such a shift tonally and even gameplay wise. I'm like, I don't know. None of them really just none of them struck me as hard as the original Red Faction did.
Okay. Interesting. It's just such a, like, there's such a, I don't know how to describe it because, like, when I'm looking at videos and photos of the Red Faction games, all I see is that it's either underground or it's brown and dirty because you're on Mars. And I know that it's like certain people may not like that sort of aesthetic and that color palette and that sort of like setting. And it's a very sort of like, you have to really hone in on sort of the game's features and the gameplay, because a lot of it, I don't want to say it looks the same, but it is very sort of like, there's a lot to sort of, or not a lot to sort of see really in these games.
Yeah, you're right. I think it was one of the main criticisms of Red Faction was that it's looks the same pretty much the whole way through. I think, and it is pretty dull. For some reason as a kid, I just didn't care about that. And part of it, of course, is because the game is driven by the technology of the I think it was called Geomod was the technology they were excited about blowing stuff up. It only works in some scenarios, right? In some environments, like if you're in, and there are bits that aren't red rock underground. There's like corridors and stuff, but But yeah, it's not super interesting. I think the geomod stuff was cool, but it came with some baggage around like, well, limitations on what you could do in terms of your level design. And it meant that like some bits obviously just weren't destructible. Obviously not everything can be destructible. They sort of pushed that a bit in sequels. I think Red Faction Guerrilla, there's a lot more like you can destroy whole buildings or whatever.
Yeah.
But you still obviously that creates a lot of problems for level design and that you still need to be able to traverse the level and get to where you need to go. You can't just be able to destroy all the walkways and then suddenly you're left stranded. I guess you can do that, but from a gameplay point of view, they limited that so that you could actually complete the game. But it definitely was quite samey all the way through. I mean, I've played it recently. There's a mod called Dash Faction, which makes it playable on a modern PC. Because I think the original doesn't even support widescreen. I think you need the mod to support widescreen resolutions and stuff. So I think I've got an ultra wide at home. And I think I got it working with ultra wide resolutions, which was kind of cool. And playing it back, like playing it now, it's like, obviously you're just like, well, this isn't, I don't know what it was about this game that really hooked me. I don't know what it was, but, you know, playing it now, I was like, it has not aged well. Whereas you play Half-Life now, I think it's definitely aged better. There's a lot more going on in Half-Life. And I mean, I almost played completely through a remake of Half-Life. But yeah, there's still something about Red Faction that, I don't know, it's charming and nostalgic for me. But what I remember, like, as much as the campaign is very samey, a lot of what I spent my time in was the multiplayer. And it was much more common back then, that you could do split screen multiplayer on consoles. But that was so good, being able to just sit and do like, you know, sit on the couch with friends after school and play Red Faction multiplayer, just shooting each other. There were some great weapons in the game. There was like a rail gun, which I used and abused so much, because it let you like see through walls. Heat sort of detecting scopes. And then being it was like a rail gun, basically. You could shoot through walls and stuff. Oh, man, it was so good. Loved it so much. And then I played online as well, which was also fun. On PC, I played a lot online. I just played the shit out of it. Loved it so much.
Yeah, I mean, I was actually going to sort of ask, I guess, as a sort of a way to wrap this up all nicely. You did sort of mention like you had a sort of difficulty explaining why the game was so influential and sort of important for you, but I guess you almost sort of like sort of summed it up there. It was because of, you know, you were playing with friends and getting such a good time out of it. Like, I assume that's part of it for you, like just having that opportunity to sort of connect with not only your friends, but obviously at that time, obviously going online and playing online PC games, which is nowhere near the sort of level that it is now. But it must have been sort of a really big experience for you.
Yeah, I mean, certainly playing games with my friends was huge. Like, all my friends played games. And we had LAN parties and stuff. They'd come over to my house and we'd set up computers and we'd just play, you know, a lot of the games that we've talked about already, Quake and Call of Duty and the half like Counter-Strike and the sort of stuff. We'd just play all these games until the wee hours of the morning. And yeah, they were absolutely formative years. But like in terms of like, because, I mean, this show's all about games that influence you, right? Like, it's all about... Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about it from that point of view, and I'm like, I don't know if there's, like how much... I've never thought about games as being something that's, like, influenced my life and career terribly much other than just being a fun pastime.
Okay.
But I think these games... What was really... Red Faction is, you know, I was definitely lured in by the cool technology of the geomod stuff. It was a marketing point. It didn't really impact the game much. Like, it didn't really change the way you play the game. But, like, it, you know, it blew my mind being able to, like, shoot shoot through walls and like just like do make tunnels that went nowhere. But like it was just like, I'd never been able to do this before. Shooting glass that shatters onto it and all the cool like physics stuff. And so, like, you know, that was for the time, it was really, really impressive stuff and blew my tiny little child mind. And I think like gaming, Red Faction and the other like computer games that I was playing was my introduction into computers and technology. And so I learned how to use computers because I wanted to play games, I think is what...
Okay.
It made computers fun for me, right? And so I became a bit of a computer nerd through all that. And it's like, the games weren't running well. So like I got into, like, I remember like in high school being like, oh, I really want a Radeon 9800 or whatever. Like I was just lusting over graphics cards and stuff like that. And that was like high school for me. And then I got good at computers. I loved building computers. My dad really encouraged that as well. I helped him build a lot of the computers that we had at home. Mucking around with networking and troubleshooting so that we could actually play LAN games. That was all formative stuff. And like my first job before I was even old enough to have a job, because how old do you have to be to have a job in this country? It's like 15 and 9 months or some weird rule like that.
I think it was 14 and 9 months. Yeah,
it was 14 and 9 months. I think before I even was doing that, I was building computers for people like friends and family who wanted a computer built, because at the time the option was to go to, I don't know, Harvey Norman or something and buy a Hewlett Packard or a Dell or something like that. And I could build it cheaper. Like, and so friends are like, oh, I want a cheap computer. I'm like, I could build you a cheap computer for like $500. I could build your computer. So I'd go buy the bits and do it all. And so that was, I did that. And then my first actual job out of school, I had a computer building business, basically a very, very, very small business, but that's how I got started. And then I got a job at a computer shop, fixing computers and stuff. And all that was, you know, through gaming, forcing that kind of interest in computers and technology and thriving for the best performance I could get out of computers and that sort of thing. And then I think like that extended on into, I think the learning computers, learning technology, just getting good at that stuff is what empowered me to be creative. Because I'm not someone, I've never really had any artistic ability, really. My sisters could draw. That was really cool. And I was always kind of jealous that my sisters could draw. Like, I want to be able to, I loved The Simpsons. I did that animation that won that award, the Fox Kids, you know, competition. That was a combo of my sister being able to draw stuff and then me being able to bring that into an animation program on the computer and make it move and record sound and throw it all together in a very, like, I mean, looking back on it, very rudimentary way. but like, I think computers gave me the ability, suddenly I could create stuff that I just could not do otherwise. I'm not crafty. I'm not good at design and drawing, and I can't make stuff with my hands really. I can't sing. I can sort of a little bit play piano, but I'm pretty scrappy at it. But computers, it was like, wow, I can make anything kind of. And so that really opened my eyes. In sort of my high school years, and you know, I learned like Flash and Dreamweaver. I started like programming, like doing HTML, PHP, JavaScript, SQL stuff so that I could make websites. And so, it's what got me into coding. And I was even trying to make games and stuff. I had a thing called Duck Basic where I could make games. And then that interest in technology went on through to like camera equipment, which got me interested in, and that's why I ended up going to, you know, study film and TV, was because I wanted to work with cameras, loved camera gear, still love camera gear, such a camera nerd. and then that followed through into, you know, all the stuff I do now. It's like live broadcasting, TV stuff and studio. I loved studio. It's like a studio, it's all the technology is really what gets me excited. It's like all the gadgets and cool equipment. You know, we've got LED walls. They're really fun to have in the studio. Vision switching stuff in the control room and routing. And I don't know. It's just a passion for that, which really came from me just wanting to play games on a crappy computer at home and wanting to like upgrade it, make it better and play better games. And yeah, that it's been an interesting journey.
Yeah, that's a very poignant and very fitting way to sort of wrap things up. And hopefully you weren't operating at a massive loss with your computer building for your friends. That sounded like if you're buying those parts yourself and then selling a computer for $500, I feel like you might be making a considerable loss.
Well, yeah, I was definitely undervaluing my labor, that's for sure.
I think that is the perfect way to round off today's episode. But Evan, it has been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. Where can people find you on the internet, on the socials, and where can people get involved with your work?
Well, you can go to you can find Gamey. That's the show that we were talking about earlier. It's a really fun show about video games. It's mostly just a comedy, silly comedy show. But it's a lot of fun. It's just on YouTube. You can go to just YouTube and type in Gamey. Or you can podcast it too, which some people do. I think it's much more fun to watch. But if you're someone who consumes content while commuting or whatever, you can find us on Spotify and, I don't know, whatever other apps you use to listen to podcasts. We should be across all of them. I run Stupid Old Studios. We're in Melbourne, Australia, just making comedy stuff. You can Google us. I think we're at Stupid Old on most of the social channels. And our website is stupidoldstudios.com. And we were also talking about Comedy Lab earlier, which is this new initiative we're doing. It's a crowdfunded initiative to make all our resources, studio stuff, equipment, crew and stuff, all available to comedians for free. And if you want to support that or just learn more about it, it's comedylab.com.au. And my name's Evan, and I'm on Twitter and Instagram and stuff. I'm either Stupid Old Evan or I'm at EvanMS, depending on which platform it is. And I can't remember which.
I think the listeners will be keen enough to figure that one out on their own. But
you'll find it. How many Evan Munro Smiths are there in the world? Well, only one, I think. I think I'm really? The only one.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, that's a bombshell to end today's episode. But yes, and everyone
not
should...
that common a name in the end, really.
And everyone should definitely be donating to Comedy Lab to help out the wonderful people at Stupid Old Studios. Some awesome work that they are doing there. And of course, you can also follow One Perfect Game at OPG Pod on X, formerly known as Twitter. I don't know what to call it now. And of course, you can always follow me at It's Tilby. But from me, Matt Tilby, and my very special guest, Evan Munro Smith, it is goodbye for now. Take care.
Bye.